Okay, we're going to start, I think.
Okay.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome another day. So today's topic is to have a look at Medrash, meaning not to learn Medrashim necessarily, which maybe we'll do tomorrow, but to understand the concept of Medrash. A very involved topic, lots of different views and approaches. What I'm going to try and share with you is what I believe is the normative, mainstream Jewish approach to Medrash and coming from most commentaries and so on and so forth. And just to understand our whole, what do we need it for, what it is it literal, is it true, is it so on and so forth. Because we know that when we talk about Medrash, I'm sure many of you have come across this, Medrash can be very weird sometimes, like it can be really strange stories, right? You read stories or read things which seem beyond imagination, right? But I think it's really important to understand where its role is in Jewish learning and what it's all about. So let's begin by something more sort of something that people are familiar with. And that is a very fundamental principle. The fundamental principle is that when Hashem gave us the Torah, Torah is given to us on many, many levels. Okay. One way to structure it, those levels, is the four famous levels of Torah learning, which is Pardes. It stands for the word Pardes, which means orchard. And the Pardes is an acronym for Pshat, Remez, Drush, and Sod. Right? Pshat, Remez, Drush, and Sod. Pshat means the literal meaning of the Pasuk, right? When you say literal doesn't mean the translated version, right? Sometimes you read a sentence, like I'll give you an example in English. If someone says, I'm taking a bath. Right, it doesn't mean they're taking the bath away, right? That means it's way special. So when we say we read a pasuk in the Tanakh or the Chumash, so there's what Rashi calls the pshat. What does the pasuk actually mean on its face value, right? Then we have something called remez, which are hints. Like for example, we're not going to go into remez today at all, but an example of remez would be a gematria. So for example, you say something is a gematria. Gematria is part of Jewish learning. If it's done legitimately, unfortunately today people just make up gematrias that don't have any meaning, but right? I once had a computer program that you could type in someone's name and it'll tell you any pasuk in Tanakh or part of a pasuk which is gematria. So it's a great way to prepare speeches for a wedding or something, but actually has no meaning whatsoever. Unless you are a great tzaddik or a great mukubal or someone who's of great stature who sees the connection. Anyways, then there's a connection which is expressed and manifested through the gematria, right? But gematria is part of learning. Pirkei Avos says so. But it's a remez. In other words, this hints to that. So therefore, I'll give you an example. So, one that comes to mind. So there's a gematria, the Balaturim is known for gematrias. So there's a part where it talks about the story of Pesach Sheni, when there were people who couldn't bring the Korban Pesach because they were Tomeis. Now, so if you read the Pasuk, the simple reading of the Pasuk is, it was time to bring the Korban Pesach. There were certain people who couldn't bring it because they were Tomei, they were impure. Why were they impure? So the Gemara says already that because one opinion is that they were carrying the bones of Yosef. So if you look at the Balaturim, he takes part of the Pasuk, Anoshim, Hoyutmeim, Nefesh Adam or something, and he says, Begematria is Aroinu Shel Yosef, the coffin of Yosef. So that's a remez. That's what we mean by remez. Okay. But the main thing I want to focus on today is the third one, which is Drush, which we'll come back to in a minute. The fourth one is Sod. Sod means esoteric, mysticism, the Kabbalistic interpretation of whatever we are learning. When we talk about Drush, what does Drush mean? So I think the definition of Drush means, what do you think it means?
Maybe learning.
Sorry?
Maybe something related to learning.
Yes, so Drush means to interpret, right? But it's an interpretive form of learning, which means it's a type of learning where you take a verse, for example, you take a pasuk, and you learn something, you derive something out of that pasuk, for example, right? But it's not the simple meaning of the pasuk necessarily. So it's an extrapolation of the pasuk, it's a derivation of the pasuk. It's not necessarily the pshat, okay? Now that's one of the areas of learning drush. Now what's important is, of course, that all these parts of Torah are true, which means this is the beauty of Torah. The beauty of Torah is that you learn one pasuk in Chumash or one Gemara even, right? Even Gemara has different layers. For example, it says the Arizal, the way he would learn Talmud, the way he would learn Gemara, which was he would learn 6 days of the week. Every day he would learn a different way of understanding the Gemara halachically. And on Shabbos he would learn the very same Gemara kabbalistically, right? So is the Gemara trying to tell you halachic stuff, or is it trying to tell you Kabbalah? The answer is both. That's the beauty of Torah. The Torah is that the way the HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the way God gave us the Torah, is that the Torah is multi-layered. Multi-layered, each one expresses a particular understanding of the verse. One's not more true than the other. That's a mistake people often make. Right? One's not more true than the other. One might be more the pshat, one might be more the non-pshat, the interpretation. Right? Now they're all these ways of learning. I'm gonna define drush in a moment a little bit much more than this, but just that's drush means we look at something and it's more the interpretation, not the pshat. So just have a look at the handout that I gave you, which I'm sorry it's not copied very well because I was in a bit of a rush and I took it from somewhere, a handout that I saw online and just had some nice things there, so I copied and pasted. No, it's here. Those on Zoom, don't worry because the handouts are just very short, so don't worry about it. Another way for drush, which we find, is agoda. Agoda means like stories in the Gemara, or lessons that we learn from Chumash, or things like that. Also a part of drush, right? So let's have a look at the first source. It's Talmud Yerushalmi. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi said, Mikra, Mishnah, Talmud, va'agoda. Mikra, which means psukim, like the pshat of the psukim. Learning Mishnah, learning Talmud, Gemara, which is halacha, Agada, which is more the agadaic part of Torah, the stories, the lessons, and so on and so forth. Va'afilu masha Talmud vasik osid lahoyrois lifnei rabbi, or any chiddush or any legitimate Torah concept which will be taught by any student before his teacher, ne'amar l'moshe misinai, was all given to Moshe Rabbeinu at Sinai. That's a very, very important part of understanding what we're going to learn today, right? If something is part of Torah, no matter what part of Torah it is, correct? It was given to Moshe Rabbeinu at Sinai. Now, what does that mean? So, I don't know. Let's take someone. So, Moshe Feinstein, a great tzaddik, a great poysik, right? Great halachic authority. He wrote a book called Igros Moshe, Letters of Moshe Rabbeinu. Letters of Moshe Feinstein, right? So what, that was given at Sinai? So Moshe Rabbeinu learned Igros Moshe? What does that mean, it was given to Moshe at Sinai? Right? And this is an important thing to understand, because often the Torah talks about...
It means it was given directly by God.
What does that mean? That particular book was given, right? No, it doesn't. Obviously doesn't mean that. But what it means is that when Hashem gave the Torah, He gave Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebaalpeh. He gave the written Torah and the oral Torah. He gave many things which were hidden and not given, not revealed at the time, they were revealed later. And He gave a mechanism, He gave a way to learn Torah and to interpret Torah. It's a little bit like the analogy is, if you plant a seed, and from the seed grows a big tree, so was the tree in the seed?
Yes.
Were there leaves and branches in the seed? No. So what does it mean the seed? What does it mean the tree was in the seed? It means the DNA, I don't know, the properties, everything that's in the tree, everything, not just the fruit, every leaf, every piece of bark, every branch, everything, every twig that's in the tree was all potentially in the seed in some level or another, in some form or another, because if it wouldn't be, it wouldn't come out. Yeah? Simple. So therefore, the same thing. When Hashem gave many, many halachas orally when the Torah was given, but some of the ways He gave Moshe Rabbeinu the methods of interpretation. He planted the seeds of Torah. So for example, let's say Kabbalah, for example. Mysticism was a very, very important part of Torah. They didn't learn it in the Midbar Sinai. They didn't learn it until much, much later. It was all given at Sinai. It was revealed later. In every generation, different parts of Torah are revealed, which makes it understandable, therefore, that every part of Torah, if it's a legitimate part of Torah, not if it's made up stuff, but if it's learned the way Torah should be learned, if it's studied the way Torah should be studied, then it's a legitimate part of Torah, it's true, I'm going to define the word true in a couple of moments, but it's absolutely true and it's eternal. Right? Now, let's go back to the Dalit. Let's go back to Drush. Drush means that there's an interpretation of a pasuk, not necessarily the literal translation of the pasuk, or the pshat translation. So in Drush itself, which is where the concept Medrash comes from, right? We have two different types of Drush. We have, because where does the Gemara fit in? Like if we say that Torah is Pshat, Remez, Drush, and Soid. So what is, right? So Pshat is the literal meaning of the Pasuk, Remez is things that it hints to, Drush is interpretation, and Soid is esoteric. So you look at the whole Shas, the whole Gemara, what does that fit into? That fits into Drush. Why? Because in Drush itself, it subdivides into two. You've got what we call Medrash Halacha and Medrash Agada, right? Medrash Halacha means all the stuff that Chazal gave us to interpret Pesukim. I'll give you an example, a very basic example, right? In the Torah, it says you should put on tefillin. Men have to put on tefillin, right? Which hand do they put on tefillin? The left hand. Yeah? You don't put on tefillin, so it doesn't matter. You don't know, right?
The weaker one.
Weaker. Oh, shkoyach. So right-handed people put on the left hand, left-handed people put on the right hand. How do we know this? It doesn't say anywhere in the Torah. How do we know it? So by the way, some things in tefillin, just as an example, we actually don't, doesn't say anywhere. It's what we call halacha l'Moshe m'Sinai. There were certain halachas given to Moshe Rabbeinu at Sinai that were passed down orally from generation to generation. That's fine. But some things we do know, we interpret from the Pesukim. So it says in the one of the four times in the Torah it talks about tefillin, it says, V'hoyo l'ois al yotcha. It should be for a sign on your hand. No, how do you spell yotcha? Every teacher, yeah?
Yud dalet chaf.
Chaf sofit. Yud dalet, final chaf, right? This particular time it says in the Torah, Yud dalet chaf hey. Which if one of your students gave it to you like that, you'd mark it wrong, right? So, yeah, because that's like not spelling correctly. But that's how we read it. It says in the Torah, Yud dalet chaf hey, right? What's the pshat of the pasuk? It doesn't change. It looks like a spelling mistake. But it doesn't actually change. It still means the same thing it means everywhere else. You should put the tefillin on your hand, as a sign on your hand, right? But the Torah comes along the Gemara and says, no, Yud Keha, Yud Yotcha spelt like that, should be read as Yad Keha, the weaker hand. The weaker hand, that's how we know it should be on the weaker hand. That's not the pshat of the pasuk, right? You understand what I'm saying? The pasuk doesn't mean, I'm just giving you a very basic example of what I mean, Midrash Halacha. And there's countless and countless of things. I mean, I'll give you. There's a famous. Ve'elah Mishpatim. If you look at Parshat Mishpatim, for example, right? It says, Ve'elah Mishpatim, Mashatosim, Lifneim. These are the laws you should place before the people, talking about the laws of the Sanhedrin, or the laws of Halachas. We learn out from the fact that it says in the Pasuk, Ve'elah Mishpatim, and just before it spoke about the Mizbeach, so we learn out that the Sanhedrin has to be next to the Mizbeach, has to be in the Beis HaMikdash. That's all Medrash stuff, right? Okay. So, the Gemara is full of this. I mean, that's the whole Gemara is like this, right? Most of the Gemara is all learning halachas out of Psukim, asking questions, logical questions, rational questions, question, answer, shakal avatari, and so on and so forth. But it's really, a lot of it is what we call Medrash Halacha. There was, now, if you look in the Mishnah, what's interesting is, right, if you open up Mishnah, you'll see, Mishnah is actually not Medrash. Mishnah is just a body of law. Right. If you look at Mishnas, if you look up a Mishnais, right, 95, 99. I don't know exactly the percentage, but most of Mishnais do not give you the source. They don't tell you where you learn it out from. So Mishnah is a book of laws, right? But if you look at other forms of Tanaim, right, the Mishnah was written by the Tanaic sages. If you look at other Tanaim, they don't just say the law; they tell you where they learned it out from, right? Like a lot of brises like that, particularly. There's very, very famous bodies of works from the Tanoim called Sifri. I'm sure some of you heard of it. Sifri, Sifra, Mechilta, right? Which were written by Rabbi Shimon, by Echai, by Rabbi Akiva, by all these great Tanoim. How do you define the Sifri, the Sifra, and the Mechilta? Midrashe Halacha. They are Medrash of Halacha. That's what they are. They bring all laws we find in the Mishnah, but they tell you all the Psukim, and they learn it out from the Psukim. All those psukim, you look in the medrash of the Sifri, the Sifra, and the Mechilta, most of the time, the way they learn the pasuk is not the pshat of the pasuk, but it's the midrash of the pasuk. But it's what we call midrash halacha. So that's midrash halacha. Right, is that clear? Okay. But I don't want to talk about midrash halacha. I want to talk about midrash, the second kind of midrash. Midrash agada. Right? Midrash agada means, now that's a very broad thing. So midrash agada means, I'm sure, anyone heard of the midrash says? No, that's not the Medrash, but it comes from the Medrash, right? Or we have now what's called a little Medrash says, right? That's all based on what we call a Medrash Agada. So we have something, for example, there's lots of them, like Medrash Rabbah, Yalkut Shemoini, Medrash Tanchuma, Medrash Tiliv, many, many different Midrashim, which were written, by the way, at different stages of history. Later, they were more written later. They were from Amoroim, not so much Tanoim. For example, Medrash Rabbah was written in the 4th century. That's Amoroim. It was written by the Amoroim of Eretz Yisrael. Right? And they are not halachas. They are an interesting category. They are what we call Midrashe Agada. agadaic midrashim, which means they interpret the psukim also, sometimes not, sometimes just ideas. But it's more to do with ideas of philosophical ideas, mystical ideas, ideas that inspire us to become Yirei Shamayim, that inspire us to serve Hashem better, that tell us the background to the stories of the Chumash that we don't see in, or the stories of Esther, that we, Megillas Esther, for example, that we don't see in the simple psukim. It gives us the back end of the story. All of these things fall under this concept of Midrashi Agada. Also, there's a body of literature in the Shas itself, in the Talmud, right? Which we call Agada. So if you learn Gemara, you know that you can go pages and pages and pages, and you can be discussing a very complex halachic topic of halacha, and then suddenly the Gemara will branch off. You can have pages and pages where it just talks about other stuff. For example, I'm learning now Gemara Brachas. So Gemara Brachas, there's a thing. I think it comes in because the Gemara happens to be discussing the tefillah, the prayer you say when the koyanim are duchening, and there's a special idea that when you daven there for bad dreams, I'm sure you've seen this in the Siddur, that when a koyanim are duchening, you daven to Hashem, that all our dreams should be good, right? And the Gemara launches into like 7 pages of some wild stuff about dreams. All things about dreams and how dreams work, and what happens if you see this in a dream and that in a dream. By the way, you shouldn't worry about any of it, because the later Achronim tell us that our dreams are all nonsense, because just what we think about the day. Mm-hmm. And 50% of what we think about the day is normally nonsense, so therefore that's what we dream about, right? I mean, not you. But right? Anyway, so that kind of thing, right? An example of a medrash agada, for example, a medrash is like the Gemara says, Odom Eitz HaSod. Everyone knows this, right? A person is compared to a tree, right? You know that? So, how many drushes have been given about Odom Eitz HaSod, the person like a tree? So, Pasuk in Mishpatim, right? Not Mishpatim, in Shoftim. You say it anyway, right? Ki Odom Eitz HaSod, right? Do you know it's not Pshat of the Pasuk at all? Do you know? In the pasuk, it's a question. Okay, all the mates are sod, the person's a tree. Exactly the opposite we're at. And it's got to do with some halacha about cutting trees, and what is the whole thing, right? Oh yeah, it's about going to war. Now remember, it's about going to war, and the Torah says you go to war, you shouldn't cut down fruit trees. You're going to war, you're going to kill the enemy, right? But don't cut down the fruit trees. Okay, all the mates are sod, they're what? The people are a tree? Why should the tree suffer, right? So you kill the people, because they're the enemies, they're threatening you. You don't kill the tree. The Gemara takes Odom Eitz HaSod, and we all know this, because, I mean, lots of drush have been given on this. The person's like a tree. Is it true? Of course it's true. Is it the Pshat of the Pasuk? No, it's not the Pshat of the Pasuk. You understand? It's a Medrash. It happens to be in the Gemara, but it's a Medrash Agada. It's the way of interpreting the Pasuk on a different level. It's absolutely true. So if you ask a question, is a person like a tree? Depends what you're talking about. If you're talking about the pshat of what the pasuk means in terms of the laws of warfare, the answer is a person not like a tree. If you're asking on a deeper level, is a person like a tree? Of course a person is like a tree. On a different level, right? So they're both true. Okay. Included in this whole midrashe agada, as we call them, is all the stories that we find in midrashim, all the stories that we find in Gemara, all the many, many, many stories that the Midrashim tell us, that the Gemara tells us, which in the Gemara we call them Agada. It's all part of Medrash, but it's all part of Torah. Okay. So what's the purpose of Midrashim? So have a look at the source 2. Beautiful thing. This comes from the Sifri. Right? Beautiful, beautiful. Just encapsulates this idea. 2 and 3, there's two things there. One's called 2, one's called 3. So the Sifri says the following: Dorshe Hagodis Oimrim. Right? Ritzoincha lahakiris mishahoya omar vahoya oila. Do you want to get to know the one who said and the world came to be? In other words, you want to get to know God? Lemoid Hagodah, learn Hagodah. Right? Why? Because if you learn Agada, although you learn Midrash, you will get to know the one who said that the one that created the world. In other words, and you will learn to cleave to his ways. In other words, a very interesting thing. Now, just to explain that, go to the next one. You see Ovester of Nosa, another sort of Midrashic compilation. It's like a Pirkei Avos, but it's Rav Nosson. It goes into much more of ethics and things like that. It says the following. Listen to this. Rabbi Yitzchak ben Pinchas Oyer, says, Kol mi sheyesh b'yodoy medrash. Anyone who knows medrash, ve'ein b'yodoy halachas, but doesn't know halachas, lo tam shel chochma. Did not taste the taste of wisdom. If you want wisdom, you have to learn halacha, meaning halacha and the interpretation of halacha, the way it's in the Gemara, right? That's the lucky. I mean, the Gemara has a different phrase, a different place where it says haroitza sheyachim yulma nezikin or something. I've got, and it's not exactly the way it says it, but if one wants to become really, really clever, you should learn like the laws of damages, because those like the complex halachic analysis of the Gemara, and talks about damages, but it's very deep and it's very analytical and it's very halachic. That's how you sharpen your mind. So therefore, if a person only learns medrash and never learns halachic analysis, he doesn't really have the taste of true wisdom, intellectual wisdom. But then it continues and says, "Kol mi sheyesh biyado halachos ve'im biyado medrash." But if you learn only halacha and you don't learn medrash, like tam tam shel yiras chet, you haven't tasted the taste of fear of sin. In other words, you can't just learn halacha. Yeah, learn halacha is a manual of what to do. But if you want to really get yiras shemaim, you want to actually cling to Hashem, get a bit of what we call yiras shemaim, like fear of heaven, and a more spiritual, deeper connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you have to learn medrash. And he continues, he says, "Hu hayo omer," used to say, "Kol sheyesh bo yodei medrash ve'ein bo yodei halachos." Anyone who has medrash but doesn't have halachos, ze gibor ve'eino mezuyin. He's like a strong person, but he has no weapons. Kol mishyesh bo yodei halachos. Anyone who has halachos ve'ein bo medrash. But if you have halachos and you don't have medrash, chalash ve'zayim bo yodei. You're like a weakling, and you got a sword, okay? But you can't fight an enemy. Right? Yesh b'yodai zeh, v'zeh giboy umezuyan. Yesh b'yodai zeh v'zeh. If you have both, you're a giboy umezuyan. You're a strong person. In other words, you're well established. You're connected to Hashem. You believe in Hashem. Things like emuna, yiras chet, kedusha, all these things come from medrash. So you're a strong person. But now you need the tools. And the tools are halacha. So therefore, you're like a strong person that has weapons. Okay. Now, there's various, if you look, I'm not going to go into this at great length, but I will mention, if you look in throughout the different generations, there are definitely different approaches to the concept of Medrash, right? In the literature of the Ge'onim, you'll find one sort of approach to Medrash, much more sort of, like they caution, the emphasis there is they caution people not to rely on Medrash in terms of halacha. It almost seems, if you learn the Ge'onim, that they duck downplaying the concept of Medrash. The Rambam, who's often known as the more rational one, although it's disputable if you can call the Rama rational necessarily, but sometimes does take rational applause, sort of approaches medrash as more philosophical thing, philosophical ideas. Later on, you have the achronim, for example, looking just the last one on the handout, the Radvaz says, for example, he says, "Da, you should know, ki yesh pa agoda," that if you look at agoda in midrashic stuff, you'll find dvar nigla v'nister, you'll find the open revealed part of Torah, which is more the halachic part of Torah, that's more the midrashi halacha, and the nister. Hanigla Moshe Chesalev, he says the nigla sort of pulls your heart, but the nister litna l'yodichein, but the nister is for those that understand these ideas of Kabbalah. And many, many people have written, for example, the Vilna Gaon writes it, and a very similar thing appears in Tanya, actually, interestingly enough, that in the agadas, in the midrashic part of the Gemara, I'm talking about more the agadai, not the midrashi halacha, but more the adrashi agada, that in the Midrashi Agada lies the greatest secrets of Torah. Okay. So what do we have from that? We have that Medrash is a very important and very critical part of Torah. Now, actually, what's unfortunate is that many people don't learn Medrash, right? That's one unfortunate thing. The other unfortunate thing is that a lot of people who have heard of Midrashim or maybe even learned Medrash, they have a very, very distorted view of how Medrash works. So it's important to understand both things. Number one, it's important to learn Medrash. Like, for example, there was always a criticism on some yeshivas where, of course, the emphasis is where they learn Gemara, in-depth halachic analysis, that if they're learning Gemara and suddenly they hit upon a couple of pages of Agada, they'd skip it out, right? Because, you know, that's not yeshiva. Yeshiva is to learn in-depth halacha. Some people feel that's really, really bad. It's part of Torah. It's an important part of Torah. It gives you a different perspective and a different component of Torah than halacha does. So therefore, it's important to learn. Or, and it isn't like, so for example, in Alter Rebbe brings in Tanya, that there was a tradition in many, many places, now it's not so much anymore, but there was a tradition in many, many shuls, many shtetls, that between Mincha and Mairiv, every single evening, they would learn Ein Yaakov. Now, Ein Yaakov is a compilation of, someone put together, all the Agadita in the Gemara, all the Midrashi parts of the Gemara, took it out of the Gemara and put it into like six volumes. Right, so you read all the stories of the Midrashim and the end-up stuff. And it was sometimes thought that the reason for that is because who used to come to Mincha Ma'ariv in the shtetl? It wasn't the great rabbis of the Mincha Chamim. The simple guys who were working in the field, they would come to Mincha Ma'ariv. A, they weren't that learned. B, sometimes the intellectual capacity wasn't that strong. And C, they were tired after a whole day working in the field. So what, you're going to start learning an in-depth stuff with them? To learn, hey, Yaakov, it's easy, it's stories, it's nice, right? Al Rebbe Tani says not like that. He says, no, it's very important to learn, and Yaakov to Mincha Ma'ariv, Sheroiv Soidois HaTorah Gnuzimbo. Because most of the secrets of Torah are hidden in Ein Yaakov. That's why it's so important to learn Ein Yaakov. Which is why, of course, a lot of Kabbalah, a lot of Hasidus, a lot of Hasidic books and so on and so forth very, very often are based on Medrash. So we learn that obviously it's a part of Torah, it's holy, it's true, and it's eternal. Now, what we have to understand, this always bothers people, is what does it mean it's true? We learn in Medrash, you'll see some really, really, which we would call as hopefully semi-rational people, we'd call like way out crazy stories, right? Things that you think to yourself, this could this really be? Anyone can think of an example?
Vashti's tail.
Sorry?
Vashti's tail.
Vashti's tail. Yep. Moshe Rabbeinu, how tall was Moshe Rabbeinu? What? 10 amos. 10 amos is about 5 meters tall. So the Medrash says it's 5 meters tall. No? You think he was my 5 meters tall? What do you think? Huh? Moment of truth here. Do you think he was really 5 minutes tall?
And how tall was everyone else?
Ah. No, they weren't that tall. They were regular tall. The Gemara says that the average height of a person is Gimel Amos, 4 amos. 3 amos, sorry. That's 1 point. No, see, imagine the scene, Moshe Rabbeinu, tell me, does it make sense? Doesn't make sense, right? So, what's Pshat? It happens to be in this case, not every Medrash is literal, by the way. Okay. But I want to give a very important introduction to that. You see, often you hear people saying, no, this can't be literal. It's not literal. I'll cite you sources that not all Midrashim are not literal, which, by the way, happens to be true. Not all Midrashim are literal. Right? I'll tell you in a second. I'll tell you what the Maral says in a few moments. But I want to lay a sort of foundation to this, right? Because true and literal are two different words. Right? Something can be true and it's not literal. Okay? So I will tell you that, this is a machloekus, we're showing him exactly which Midrashim works what, but overall, not every Medrash is literal. It doesn't mean it's not true. It's a different language. Okay? I'll tell you what the Maral says exactly about this Medrash. But so was Moshe Rabbeinu 10 Amos? The Medrash says, is it true? 100%. Does it mean he was actually 5 meters tall? Not necessarily. Right? However, the important question to ask ourselves is, why is that important to know? And this is what I want to really emphasize, because I think it's hashkafically extremely important. A lot of the times when we hear that a Medrash is not literal, we have almost like a sense of relief, right? Oh, thank God, I really was struggling with that Medrash, right? I mean, come on, seriously, this is like fairy tale stuff, right? Or Chas V'Shalom, people translate in secular literature, they translate Medrash sometimes as legend. That's a very, very bad translation of Medrash, because that's heresy. That's Medrash is not legend.
Translation.
Medrash is Medrash. I don't know. I don't know.
It's good. I have this problem all the time.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, because there's different parts of Medrash. Some people are more like lessons. Some people ethics. Some things are more stories. It's hard to define it as one word. I don't know. Midrashic. I don't know. Right. So this is the part I want to say. Right. So, for example, I heard a shiur once with someone who quoted a Rashi in Chumash. I'm going to get to that Rashi a little bit later. Rashi Chumash says, and some of you, I'm sure, familiar with this, that Batya, the daughter of Paro, went down to the river, and she found the basket that Moshe Rabbeinu was in. Correct? It's a Medrash. Vatishlach es amosa, and she sent her hand to get the basket. So, of course, the problem with that pasuk is, people don't send their hands. What do you mean he sent their hands? So we find two pshatim. One pshat is that she sent her maidservant. Amosa can mean maidservant. Sent her maidservant, go chap the basket. She opens up the basket, there's a crying baby, it's Moshe Rabbeinu. The other one is that no, she actually stretched out her hand, but it was not far enough because it was already gone into the river. So her hand extended. Right? Her hand became long and I got the thing. Right? So I once heard a shiur from someone, which I completely disagree with. Not that screen necessarily at the end with the final thing, but he his premise was, you don't actually think that's literal, right? What do you mean this tree? Hand stretched out. Hand stretched out. My question is, why not? Because it comes from a very important perspective of how we approach Torah, right? See, Torah is not an intellectual exercise. Torah contains tremendously deep intellect. But Torah is not by definition an intellectual subject. Torah is the wisdom of Hashem. Torah doesn't exist without emunah, correct? In fact, the Gemara says that Torah can go two ways. If you learn Torah and you learn incorrectly, it can become a poison, even though we call Torah the tree of life, Eitz Chaim, right? Says the Gemara, Zocha, if you have a schus, the Torah will be a potion of life. If you don't have a schus, the Torah will be a poison. Why? Because Torah has to be learned with the right perspective. Torah has to be learned that the Torah and Hashem are one. And therefore the Torah and our Emunah are one. And by definition, what does Emunah mean? Emunah means faith. By definition, Emunah means something which is higher than Seichel, higher than intellect. It transcends the rational, right? Jews are not a rational people. We are the people of the book. We are smart, maybe. We learn and study. It's part of our DNA, and it's part of the fabric of being Jewish, is to study and learn and understand and ask questions and analyze. But by definition, we are not a rational people. The axioms, the yesodos, the foundation that Torah is based on are not rational. They're godly, right? Part of that godly emunah is that we believe, for example, in Nevuah, we believe in prophecy. It's one of the 13 principles of faith. No, prophecy is not particularly rational, right? Just because a person is very high and is a great person, there's a time Hashem communicates to them, yeah. Right? We believe in Nissim. It's part of our belief system that there were miracles, right? Some people struggle with this. Some people try to take Kriyas Yamsuf, right? The splitting of the Red Sea, and come up with some ridiculous notion that Punkta was a volcano in that time or something, right? Why do they do that? Because they struggle with the super rational. They struggle with that Amunah. They struggle. We have a world. The world runs a certain way, and that's the way we're, right? Yeah, it's true. We're not supposed to rely on miracles. We're not supposed to, right? Hashem, the teva, the nature is. One of the 13 principles of our faith is Tchiya Samesim, right? And that's irrefutable. I mean, that's one of the 13 principles according to the Rambam, right? That there will be a time of Tchiya Samesim. No, Tchiya Samesim is rational. I mean, people are going to rise from the grave. It's a rational thing. It's a ridiculous thing, right? Which I think is one of the Goyim saying. I think it's from High Goyim says that if you can believe in Tchiya Samesim, you believe in all miracles, right? In other words, I'm trying to develop a certain approach here. If you learn a Medrash, right, and the Medrash says that Paro's daughter came and her hand stretched out, it shouldn't be a problem for you. Not necessarily it did stretch out, okay? But it certainly could have. It shouldn't be a problem for us. In other words, what I'm trying to get at is this. Although we know this from Achronim, we know this from Rishonim, that not all Midrashim are literal, it shouldn't be because, oh, thank God, because otherwise I'd have a problem believing in this, right? They're not literal because they're not literal, because they don't have to be literal. In other words, I don't have to have them to be literal in order to believe in them. You understand what I'm trying to say? But they could be literal, and we shouldn't have a problem with them being literal. And if Chazal said that Vashti had a tail, maybe she didn't have a tail. Or if Moshe Rabbeinu was 10 Amasai, maybe he was 10 Amasai. Now, the Maharal brings a proof that it wasn't like that, but I'll explain to you in a minute. But it shouldn't be a problem for us, just because it sounds weird. Because this is the whole problem that is so prevalent today, that people think that what is not rational, what I don't understand, I don't do, and I don't connect to. And it's a very, very, very big problem, ashkafically. The big problem that is because we start then, maybe I don't have to do certain tefillahs because it doesn't make sense to me anymore. Maybe I don't have to keep certain mitzvahs. That's where it evolves. I mean, obviously not in this point. I mean, yeah, it becomes an evolution of a real problem that I'm only going to do what talks to my intellect. The problem with that is it's the height of arrogance, because it's the arrogance of the human being that we believe that what is the highest form of existence is understanding. And not only understanding, but human understanding, right? Part of being Jewish is two things. First of all, to understand that human understanding is not the be-all and end-all. We're nothing, right? Even the greatest genius that is a human being is nothing compared to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And second of all, HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself transcends intellect. So our Chochmah doesn't compare, is an understatement, right? Doesn't compare at all to Hashem's Chochmah. And Hashem himself is not bound by his Chochmah either. You understand what I'm saying? He transcends all concept of intellect. Intellect is a great tool. Our mind is an amazing tool. It's how we connect. It's how we understand. It's how we internalize things. Nasav and nishma. Nishma is important. We need to understand. But we are not bound by understanding. And that's a very important approach when we learn Torah. Because many parts of Torah simply don't make sense. And that's fine. As believing Jews, that's not a problem. So I'm saying, coming back to Medrash, right? When we do learn certain Midrashim, and we do learn certain things that seem to not make sense, or they seem maybe to this is part I wanted to say before. Sorry, I lost my train of thought. Because, for example, that's where it becomes a problem when we see things in the Chumash. Now, in the Chumash, we know the Gemara tells us ein mikra yetzer de pshute, right? That psukim are always pshat. So a story that happens in the Chumash happened, right? Now, Reb Chaim Goin goes through, I think it's Reb Chaim Goin, it was Chaim Goin, goes through a whole thing where there's certain exceptions to it. So, for example, I'll see if I have it here. Give me 1 second. So, for example, when contextually it's not the pshat, obviously it's not, and you can't go to the translations. For example, see, here's an example. It says, Adam Arishan called his wife Chava because she was the mother of all life, right? So was Chava the mother of all life? No, I mean, she wasn't the mother. Life is animals too, right? She wasn't the mother. She was the mother of all human beings, right? So obviously, everything that happens in the Psukim is Pshat, but Pshat is sometimes bound by context, which obviously you have to understand. That's what somebody, or explains why, for example, we can prove that HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't mean that. So for example, it says, anthropomorphisms, for example, when it says that Hashem is Eish Oichlu, Hashem is a consuming fire. Obviously, it doesn't mean literal fire because we have one of our Ikrei Emunah, one of our fundamental faith is to believe that Hashem doesn't have a physical form, right? So there are certain things, there are certain defined rules where even in the Chumash you say that things are not specifically literal. But otherwise, they are. So that's where some people have a problem. So if you have the story of Adam and Chava, which many people have a problem with because it doesn't fit scientifically, to what we know in science is. As even we believe that science is a problem. We don't fit Torah into science. We fit science into Torah, right? We fit science into Torah, right? But I mean, that's another discussion, and it's a complex discussion to understand how that all works. But if something happens in the Chumash, happens in the Chumash. Why? Because again, it all depends what the foundation is. If the foundation is that everything has to be understood and make sense, then of course Midrashim won't be literal, and nothing of the Midrashim will be literal, and the end will be that even certain parts of the Chumash are not literal, which of course is not true. But if our foundation is that no, Torah is Torah, Torah is not necessarily rational. Torah is emunah. We don't understand everything in Torah. There are lots of questions, and that's fine. If you look at the book of Bereshit, there's millions of questions. And that doesn't matter. It's fine. But if the Torah says this, there was a story of Adam and Chava, there was a story of Noach and the flood, it all seems really way out there. It's sometimes worse than some of the Midrashim. But it happened. Because it could happen. Therefore, the same thing with Medrash. Medrash doesn't have to be literal, but it could be literal. It shouldn't be a problem for it to be literal, right? So, why am I saying that? Because some Midrashim are literal. And some aren't. So, for example, the Maral says with regard to Moshe Rabbeinu being 10 amas tall, right? The Maral says it's not literal. Why? He says because we would know if it was literal. In other words, a story in the Chumash where Moshe Rabbeinu puts up a Mishkan, he goes through a whole arichus where it appears that Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't taller than the rest of the nation. He was among everyone. He was probably taller on some level because he was great in stature and great in piety, and therefore the might have manifested itself as it did. Vashola Melech says he was shuch mele bala v'kolam, he was head and shoulders above everyone else. Fine, but 10 amos it probably wasn't. In other words, not because I have a problem with him being 10 amos, but it just doesn't seem that way from the story of the Chumash. It doesn't seem the way from the whole story of Paro. He brings a number of proofs, but he says so. Therefore, because you know, according to the Gemara, Paro on the other hand was very short. Right, according to the Gemara, Paro was 1 amma, right? So can you imagine that scene, right? Paro is 1 amma, he's talking to Moshe Rabbeinu, who's like 9-10 times as big as him, right? Says the Maral, and I don't have it in front of me, and I don't remember exactly all the details, but the point is this: says Maral, is it true? Of course, it's true. Moshe Rabbeinu was 10 ammas; he was 10 ammas tall, not physically. He was 10 ammas tall on the midrashic level. Person's made up of 10 middos, he was perfect in all these 10 middos. Whatever the case is, Moshe Rabbeinu was a giant, a bigger giant than any other person that ever lived. 10 amos, a number of perfection. Maybe I'll try and source the Maharal exactly how he goes in the detail to explain it. So he says, when Paro looked at Moshe Rabbeinu, what did he see? Well, he only saw part of Moshe Rabbeinu. He saw the physical Moshe Rabbeinu. The physical Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't 10 amos tall. Right? But there was a Moshe Rabbeinu standing there that was 10 amos tall that Paro couldn't look at with his physical eyes, because that's what Medrash is many times. Medrash is not. Medrash is absolutely true. If the Medrash tells a story, it happened. Did it happen in a literal way? Not necessarily. It happened on some level. The Medrash says something, and some people explain Rashi's tale the same way. But it's not literal. Could have been literal, but it's not literal, right? There's a story, this is not a Medrash, but just to bring out the point a little bit, right? There's a story, a famous story of the Baal Shem Tov, which is told to bring out how important it is to watch one's speech and so on and so forth. Famous story of the Baal Shem Tov was in shul one morning, two people had a fight. It happens in shul sometimes, the two people have politics, so screaming at each other. So the one guy got so upset, and he said to the other guy, I'm going to be korea you kedag. I'm going to tear you up like a fish. I'm not sure what that expression means even, I guess, because fish is very soft, so I suppose it's easy to tear. I'm going to tear you up like a fish. Okay. And he went away in a huff and puff. The Baal Shem Tov called together his close talmidim, the mystics, and as he did sometimes, he wanted to show them what's happening in the higher worlds, right? Puts them into a circle, he then completes the circle, and they all start screaming out of fright. Why? They saw in the higher worlds how he's tearing him up like a fish. It's meant to tell us that when we say something, it actually creates a reality, right? I'm telling you the story because reality doesn't always mean what you see in front of your eyes, in the physical level. Because that goes together with the whole concept of understanding the spiritual side of existence. This is not the only reality. When we say something's not literal, we mean it's not literal in the physical sense. That doesn't mean it's not real. Doesn't mean it's not true. There's much more realities than this one, right? So if the Medrash says the Moshe Rabbeinu was 10 Amos, Moshe Rabbeinu was 10 Amos. Doesn't mean he was 10 Amos in the physical sense, not necessarily. It doesn't have to be that way. Now, what's interesting is that there are certain Midrashim which do have to be literal. Some of them, for example, is the ones that Rashi brings. Why? Because Rashi says like three times in the beginning of Bereishis, I don't know if it's three or four or two, whatever. He says a number of times in the beginning of Bereishis, I'm coming, my function is, says Rashi, to explain the pshat of the pasuk. We know that sometimes what Rashi does is, he brings a medrash, right? Now, how can he bring a medrash if his function is to explain pshat? Sometimes Rashi looks at the pasuk, he has no way to explain the pshat other than a medrash. So in other words, Rashi brings the Medrash to explain the Pshat of the Pasuk, which means he believes that what the Medrash says is the Pshat of the Pasuk. Right? Now, Ein Mikra Yotzei D'Pshuta, which means the Pshat in the Pasuk means it's literal. I mean, not literal as a translation, but it's the Pshat. Right? Which then sheds an interesting question with regard to the story of the daughter of Paray, because Rashi brings that Medrash. Right? The only problem with it is, which goes to another question, Rashi brings two opinions, right? So Rashi says, what does it mean by Tishlach Hasamasa? Rashi brings both ideas, that she sent her maidservant or her hand stretched out. Now, there's a question in generally, if Rashi brings two interpretations, which one does he hold as pshat? The answer is he holds they both pshat, but each one has a sort of a difficulty, a question. Now let's say he brings both. Okay. Which means so Rashi brings two interpretations of that Rashi, Midrashic interpretations, right? Because of the difficulty of the wording of the pasuk, that she sent her hand. That's not the way people normally talk. You don't send your hand, right? And Rashi brings two ideas. Either she sent her maidservant, which is not the pshat of the pasuk, or a hand stretch, which is also not literal, right? I mean, it's also not what you normally imagine the pshat of the pasuk is. So here we have a problem. Rashi brings two ideas. They both can't be true. Sorry, they both can't be true, correct? I mean, they both can't have happened, literally. So which one happened? But they both could be literal because they both pshat. So it is very possible that her hand taka stretched out, right? And I don't have a problem with that. I don't know what this guy who gave a shit. I don't know what his problem with it was. I'm not sure why. So her hand stretched out. So what? What the missing miracles, right? The only problem with that, if Rashi would only bring that pshat, I would say to you 100% literal. The only problem is Rashi brings both pshat. So that's a general problem. We know that we have many, many arguments in the Torah, in the Gemara, even halachic arguments, right? And normally we say, Eilu va'eilu divrei Elokim chai. We say they're both right. They're both part of Torah. The problem with that is, that's very nice to say when you're talking about two approaches. So you say both approaches are legitimate, right? That's how we normally say. So let's say, I don't know, Beis Shammai says you should light 8 candles for the first night of Hanukkah, Basil says you should light 1 candle. They're both legitimate, which means they're both true and they're both part of Torah. And then the Torah gives us a system of how we have to pask and how do we actually rule. So we do like Beis Hillel, but Beis Shammai is still right, right? So that we know is a standard concept in the Torah. That you can have two opinions and they're both right, which means they're both legitimate and they're both part of the holiness of Torah. But when you have something describing something that happened, so they can't both be true in the literal sense, correct? That's a problem, yeah? So the answer to this is very simple. And it's based on, I'm sharing with you, is based on a Tosfos in the Gemara. There's a famous Gemara that talks about, I'm just getting mixed up. There's two subjects. I'm not sure which subject it talks about. I think it's this one. It talks about, it's based on a Tosfos which says, what was created first, the heaven or the earth? You know, it says in the Chumash, Bereishis bara Elokim ha-shamayim ve-ha-aretz. The machlokes is actually what was created first, heaven or earth? Okay. So, two opinions in Gemara, they're both right. Well, both can't be right. I mean, that can't be right in a literal sense, at least, right? One of them was created first. Similar thing, we have a machlokes in Gemara. Was the world created in Nisan? The world was created in Tishrei, right? What do we follow?
Tishrei.
That's what we think, right? Yeah, we do. Most of the time we think that. Because that's what we say in Rosh Hashanah, this day the world was created, right? Interesting enough, have you ever heard of Bircha Sachamo, the blessing we make on the sun? And once in every 28 years? Oh, sorry? We did it a few years ago, right? Right? Oh, a few years ago, it's already like I think 12 years ago. But happens one every 28 years. It's about making a bracha when the sun reaches exactly the same spot and position it was at the time of creation. It's always on a Wednesday morning, which makes sense because Wednesday is the day that the sun was created. There's only one problem. It happens always in Nisan, not in Tishrei. Right? So when was the world created, right? Okay, two opinions. Now, they're both in Torah. They're both part of the holiness of Torah. They're both part of the truth of Torah. Well, Tachlis, when was the world created? So Tosfos says, very simple. One opinion is when it happened actually, in the physical sense. One is when it happened b'machshava, in the potential. That's when God thought about it. In other words, so let's take heaven and earth, for example, right? So let's say, no, or that's the creation of the world. In other words, you can say Nisan means the world was created, but in a different level. I'll give you an example of what I mean. Even by a person, you can say this, right? How much more so by Hashem. If I decide to build a house, I don't mean me literally because I couldn't build anything, but but let's say I was, let's say I could, let's say I was a builder, right? Let's say I was a builder and I designed this house, right? I designed the house and I decided, you know, I want 3 rooms, 7 rooms, 4 bathrooms, whatever. Dining rooms look a certain way and I've got it in my mind exactly what I'm going to do. I haven't built a thing yet, not even one brick, right? Does the house exist yet?
In your mind.
Oh, so it depends what that means exists, right? That does exist, as I would normally say in English, does the house exist? No, of course not. The house does exist. It exists in my mind. Now, for a human being, an existence in someone's mind is a very weak existence because, a million things exist in my mind that never ever happened, right? Yeah. With Hashem, it doesn't work like that. If something exists in a certain spiritual level, exists in Hashem's machshava, it exists. It exists differently. Like a tree exists differently in a seed. It exists there, but it exists in a different way. Different context, different type of reality. So when was the heaven created first or the earth created first? One of them was created first in the level of thought, in Hashem's mind, so to speak, whatever that means, right? Was the world created in Nisan or Tishrei? One of them is correct in when Hashem planned the world. There was already a form of existence. Now, in Hashem's world, when we talk about something existing in the mind of Hashem, whatever that means, Machshava of Hashem, that's a real existence. In fact, it could even be a stronger existence than this existence. Right? Because the more spiritual something is, the stronger it is, not the weaker it is. Us people, we think something is stronger when we can touch it. Right? But it's not necessarily the truth. Ruchnius is stronger than Kashmir's. Just has different frames of reference. Understand? So absolutely, they're 100% both true. Let's go back to the Rashi. Rashi says there's two pshatim in this pasuk. One pshat is her hand stretched out. One pshat is, no, she sent a maidservant. They both pshat, because Rashi brings them in Rashi, in Pshat HaShemirka, means they could both be literal. Are they both necessarily literal? No, because in fact only one of them happened. One of them happened, they both happened, because they're both true. One of them happened in a literal sense, one of them happened in a spiritual sense. Like similar to the Maharal's explanation of Moshe Rabbeinu being 10 numbers tall. Right? So she sent her maidservant. Did she actually send a maidservant? I don't know, because maybe her hand stretched out. And she sent a maidservant, you know, whatever that means spiritually. Or maybe she physically sent a maidservant. And her hand stretched out, whatever that means spiritually. Correct? But the point I'm trying to make is they could be literal. It's not a problem, but they're not necessarily. The most famous one, by the way, is what the Vilna Gaon has, a whole book, a whole Akuntras, where he writes, explains there's a very famous body of Agadata, wild stuff, in Baba Basra called the Rabba Barbar Chana stories. Rabbi Chana says he went and he saw in a vision and there was a fish that was bigger than a city and there was a, he was an island, and then he realized it's some sort of crocodile, all kinds of things, right? Crazy, crazy, crazy things. To me, actually, it wouldn't bother me if they were literal, but they happen to be not literal, because that's all the Achronim say that. Vilna Gaon says, Lubavitcher Rebbe brings it down, lots of people bring down that actually those stories are not literal, because they don't have to be literal. Hashem doesn't make miracles for nothing. In other words, for some Midrashim, I guess this is the point. Some Midrashim, we need to not have a problem if it is literal. The only thing is, if it is literal, it's miraculous. Now, we also have a principle that Hashem doesn't make miracles for nothing, which is probably part of the reason why they're not always literal, because they just taught to us as a lesson. The stories happened, but in a spiritual way, to give us a lesson. Many of these Midrashim, of course, have lots of deep lessons and of these things, but the bottom line is, Midrash is a very, we only touched the surface today, unfortunately, but the bottom line is that Midrash is a very, very important of Torah. And the important part is that Midrash, every word of Midrash is as true as every Blat Gemara and as true as every Pasuk in Chumash. It doesn't, true doesn't always mean that it's literal. The Midrashim are literal, the Midrashim aren't literal. And we need to just follow the Mefarshim and the guide of our great Gedolim and Tzaddikim to know which ones we need to understand on one level, on a different level. But they definitely a very important part of learning. We should learn them and we should approach them as any other part of Torah. Okay? No, it wasn't apparently. Okay. Thank you all those joining us on Zoom and have a great day.
Thank you,
Rabbi. Thank you. Rabbi Rappaport is now giving a lesson in a lecture in the shul, in the Mizrahi shul, on, I think it's adoption and halacha. It's a very interesting topic, so make your way there, please. Welcome. I'm just gonna. Oh, I'm sorry. Could you do me a big favor? Run across to me to Mizrahi, but just be careful. This is on. It's okay. It should be on. But you need to take this as well.
Yeah.
Let's give it to Yaakov. He needs it now because I'm doing a shiur. No, Yaakov Leviton.
I don't think he's there.
We better be there.
I think he's with his daughter
at last time. I certainly hope not.
I don't know.
No, she's there.
I've already sent Rabbi Rappaport.
What? Yeah, okay, so now I'm sure Yaakov's there.